This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-purpose DIY website platform for pros and beginners alike. This week in Retronauts, in the words of the poet N. Peart, "Icy red hurts my head." Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, your host this episode, revisiting familiar territory. We haven't been there in a couple of years, but it's always worth revisiting an old favorite topic. And this topic is Virtual Boy, because I wrote the greatest book ever about Virtual Boy. And we have with me this episode the gentlemen who have written the second greatest book about Virtual Boy ever. My question for both of you is, first, how dare you? No, we have a familiar person to Retronauts listeners joining this episode, but also a newcomer. So if you could please introduce yourself, a person who has never been on this show before.
Hi, thanks for the welcome. Thanks for the invite. My name is Jose Zagal. I'm a professor at the University of Utah, where I teach and do research in the division of games. So we have a lot of students who are interested in working in the games industry and learning more about games as a form of culture, and also interested in making them. And so that's basically my day job.
All right. And of course, the other person here calling in from the great city of Raleigh, North Carolina, just a couple of miles from where I am.
That's true. I'm Benj Edwards. I'm currently the AI reporter at Ars Technica. So that's my... and co-author of this awesome new book, which is called... Who wants to introduce it?
I'm open to either one of you. As you can see, I dress for the occasion. I've got my red and black eyeglasses on.
Cool. Can you see in stereo out of those?
I can't, actually. My eyes are terrible, which is, why it's ironic that I did a complete retrospective series on Virtual Boy, because I'm terrible at seeing Virtual Boy.
Yeah, you have. I remember you mentioned that, a depth perception issue.
Yep. Good times.
Fascinating. Well, the book is called Seeing Red, Nintendo's Virtual Boy, and it's obviously by Jose and me, and it's an MIT Press book in the Platform Studies series. So it started, you know, Ian Bogost and Nick Montfort, is that how you pronounce their names? They started that series in, what year was it? Maybe 2009, Jose?
Thereabouts, I guess.
Right, yeah.
Something like that, with Racing the Beam about the Atari 2600. And then they turned that into a platform studies series. And there have been a number of books, probably at least a dozen, about different game platforms. One was about the NES, which was pretty cool, and some others. So,
yeah, I Am Error by Nathan Eltice is really one of the great, insightful books about the NES. So that's actually, you know, between that and Racing the Beam, that's a that's kind of a big weight class to punch into. What made the two of you decide to first, you know, write about Virtual Boy, but also write about Virtual Boy in the context of the Platform Studies series?
So I guess I'll hop in here, because this sort of started with my interest. So when Racing the Beam came out, I was really inspired by that book. I thought, you know, here's finally a book that is not just a history. So I'm all about reading histories and learning about the people behind the platforms and the decisions made and so on. But here's someone, two people actually, because it's not just Ian by himself writing it, writing a book about actually thinking deeply about what does this technology allow to do and what was done with it and why, and kind of trying to really examine the relationship between the hardware, the games that came out, and sort of the social and cultural context in which it all happened. And for me, that was really fascinating. I've been a game scholar for many years now, and this felt like a real breakthrough moment in the scholarship in that sense, thinking about the technology and the culture and the games in a sort of cohesive way. I thought, wow, I wonder what's next. What other books would I like to read? And I'm still hoping for an Apple II one, though Lane Nooney's book is really good. I do recommend that one. Not a platform studies, but definitely a great book on the Apple II. And this got me thinking about the Virtual Boy. And I thought, Virtual Boy sounds like it would be a really easy, air quotes, book to write because there aren't that many games for it. So you could have a book where you actually look at every single game on the platform and maybe there's some story to tell there. So I put together a proposal. I sent it off. And it was soundly rejected for very good reasons. And this would be kicking around in my head for a while. I worked with an undergrad at DePaul University, Matt Zakara, and he also got excited with the Virtual Boy, and we wrote a paper together, an academic paper. And so I'd always been in the back of mind this idea of, well, let's look at this platform, which is so maligned. I didn't really know much about it in the sense of why it was maligned. And this, air quote, bad idea of looking at all the games for it. And so over the years, I sort of slowly chipped away at this book project. I put together another proposal. Ian kept on hounding me and saying, hey, when's a new proposal coming in? Come on, we're waiting. And I said, yes, I'm working on it, when I was maybe yes, maybe no, on and off. Eventually, I was able to put together a much better proposal. I was kind of really looking at what was interesting about the Virtual Boy, which what is most interesting is not the fact it only has 22 games. What's most interesting is not the fact that it was canceled pretty quickly by Nintendo. There's plenty of stories of platforms that just bombed and didn't have a lot of games. What was interesting about it was what kind of a device it was. And I don't mean just a stereo. I mean the kind of entertainment experiences it was trying to provide, what the intention was. And obviously, there's a story of the creator, right? Gunpei Yokoi, sort of the mastermind behind it, very famous designer, a very important figure at Nintendo, and the fact that he had a strong role behind that too allowed me to sort of figure out that there's more going on here that led to a better proposal. But I realized partway through the project that I was having trouble making sort of headway on this. And I thought, well, I really need to bring someone on board to help me out. Hopefully someone who can play to my weaknesses so that we can sort of create a combo team that will actually result in a much better book. And that's where Benj came into the picture. I'm the academic, and so I have the dry, dusty, sort of theoretical, perhaps boring for some people take on it. And Benj is, the reporter, the person who speaks to a broader audience, knows his history of games really well. And I think that's what allowed us to put together a book that I think fits nicely in the platform study series. And hopefully we'll see how this goes. It bridges sort of the academic and the fan and the general public divide, as it were. And that's what we're hoping the book will do. We hope it'll find an audience outside of academia as well as one within.
So how did you end up landing on Benj exactly? Benj, I don't know if that's something you can speak to or if Jose wants to talk about that.
Jose, this is great vanity for me. Let him talk about it. Vanity listening.
So I asked around different people, said, well, who's a good sort of game historian who's also sort of on the journalism side, who might be interested in this. And I went down a list of people who might be interested in this kind of project. Benj had written an article already for Fast Company on the Virtual Boy. Mm-hmm. And he had done a really interesting work there interviewing some of the people behind the original technology that Nintendo eventually licensed. And so I basically cold called him. It might have been a Twitter DM or something like that, but we said, hey, I'm working on this thing. This is my name. This is who I am. I'm not some random crackpot out of the boonies of nowhere land. What do you think? And I'll let Benj complete the story from there.
Yeah, I said, no way, Jose. just kidding. I didn't say that. I thought it was a very interesting idea. Obviously, the article in 2015 for Fast Company was very important for me personally in my career as just you know, breaking new information about the Virtual Boy, I was trying to definitively answer, like, what the hell happened with this console? Like, why did it exist? You know, how did this come to pass? You know, and so I went on just writing that article was probably like an 8-month journey or something where I did a lot of research. I put a lot of my own money into funding translations of interviews, and, you know, with a Japanese source and maybe another one and transcriptions and things like that. And it just, it ended up a nice marriage between the US side and Reflection Technology that developed the scanned linear array, which is the basic component of the Virtual Boy's displays, and the Japanese side through Gunpei Yokoi's interest in it and how they developed it from that technology they licensed from the American company. And prior to that, I think someone had written an article about the Reflection side that I didn't really know much about, but no one had really gotten much into the Japanese side. And the belief at the time I wrote the article was that Gunpei Yokoi retired in shame from Nintendo for the failure of the Virtual Boy. And luckily, I found out that that was not the case. In fact, he went on and developed the Game Boy Pocket, and then he had been planning to retire anyway, and it just happened to be one of his last couple projects there. So that felt like a good redemption for Gunpei Yokoi, too, who had sort of this curse on his name. And so, yeah, it was great. So when it came to the point of, I've been thinking about writing a book about anything at all for the last, 15 years. Just there's a lot of material to draw from or whatever knowledge. And when it came to, like, what's the coolest book you could possibly write about, like, that's really interesting and weird. And, you know, like, I love oddities. I used to write an oddities series for Technologizer about all the weirdest things about different platforms. And Virtual Boy is a weird platform, and it's always interested me for that. And I'm like, man, you couldn't pick a better book to have just like a, you know, like on your resume as like having written a book about the Virtual Boy, because it's just such a cool, weird thing. Like, this, you can't go wrong. That's the way I figure. So plus Jose, he ended up doing most of the work anyway. It's a very academic book, and I wrote kind of the meat of maybe a couple chapters, and I also collaborated on all the chapters with him, and I wrote a big appendix at the back with the with all that studies all the games, and it was relatively easy. We still put in a couple of years work on it. Mm-hmm. But Jose carried most of the weight, and he did a really great job.
How long was the collaboration? How long was this collaborative element of the book in the works? When did you guys get together and start?
Probably 2021 when you approached me, right? Something like that.
That's weird. I'm trying to think. Was this in the before times or in the...
It was during COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Like the era. It wasn't 2020, I don't think. I think it was 2021. And we set up meetings. We were meeting like every week at one point. I can't remember. And then
meeting weekly
for like 6 months. I don't know. And then we met like once a month after that for a while. And then the process was like Jose would mostly write the bulk of a chapter and I would edit it or add, and we'd discuss it. I think first we were discussing what every chapter would be. And then, so we kind of came to an agreement about what do we really think about the Virtual Boy? Like, how do we consider this? Is it virtual reality? Is it, you know, whatever? And we had to come to these sort of joint conclusions that Jose fed into his work. And then, you know, I wrote a couple of chapters and he added a lot of stuff to him. And it was a nice, it feels like a good collaboration.
Yeah, I think in collaborations, it's It's a danger to think of it like, well, I did 50% of the work and the other person did 50% of the work in terms of like hours put in, when actually a lot of the work is sort of intellectual, right? Sure, maybe I wrote more words, but we would have these meetings and I would say something and then Benji would push back and say, well, that doesn't quite make sense for these reasons. And we'd go back to the drawing board. So that's how everything gets refined and improved. Mm-hmm. Or Benji would have an idea. So, well, how do you thought about this side or this angle? And I would say, well, I hadn't really considered that, but I think I know some places to go to back that up or to support that or to investigate further. So it really is about sort of the intellectual work. For me, that's a more important thing than the, like, how many words were typed out by someone or other. The timeline, I think, is also a little bit, I just want to clarify for, I guess, the non-academic audience that academic books take a long time because the editorial process is also quite a bit longer. So once we'd finished writing the book, the manuscript is done, we send it off to the publisher, and then the publisher sends it out to a bunch of anonymous reviewers who are other academics, and they'll read the book and they'll give comments and feedback and ask for changes and so on. So then, you know, that takes a couple of months, and then those come back, and then we have a couple of months to implement those changes and so on. So the overall process, publishing process, is a bit longer perhaps than a typical book where maybe you're just dealing with an editor and then, you know, because of this review process in the middle. So yes, we spent a lot of time working on it, but I don't want to scare people. It's like, oh my God, this was like 5 years worth of work. It's like, yes, but, you know, stretched out.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the book was in the works for a while, and about the time you guys started working together is about when I published my own Virtual Boy Works book. Was that annoying to you, I have to ask, that you had this project that you'd been kind of gestating for so long, and then someone comes out and is, you know, with a book that's pretty comprehensive in terms of the Virtual Boy library?
That's a really good question, and the honest answer is I was super excited when I heard about your book, and I was disappointed I wasn't able to get my hands on it sooner because I really wanted to get to see it as early as possible. I think I put in for the special edition with like the glasses and all the mm-hmm. other nonsense, and that version got delayed. And yeah. So I'm sitting here waiting for, oh, no, where's my book? And people, there's a Discord for the Virtual Boy community. And they were like, I got my copy. I was like, dang it. Like, where's mm-hmm. mine?
Yeah, I got mine way before you, Jose. And I had to show you what was in it. So,
yeah. and I was excited because I thought, okay, if this book does well, and I hope it has, it means that there is interest. And it means that maybe there is a follow-up interest in our book. I don't see the books as competing in any meaningful way. I see them really mm-hmm. as complementary. And in some sense, I'm thankful that your book exists because it means we didn't have to do a bunch of things because, you know, you were doing them book already. So it took load off of my shoulders, at least. We do have an appendix at the end that Benjo goes over all the games in very brief detail. Had your book not existed, that appendix might have had to be a lot bigger and more comprehensive and so on. So mm-hmm. I think they really work well together.
That was my impression as well. I've read about 3/4 of the book at this point. And yeah, it covers material and perspectives that are wildly different from mine and from other coverage I've seen of Virtual Boy, both online and, you know, in other books. So I don't know if you'd like to talk about that, kind of the mission and the process. You know, what makes your book different than mine? Whereas mine is, you know, really kind of an overview of the system in terms of the chronology of its game releases and really looks at it through the lens of software. You know, how is yours different in your own words?
I guess the way I think about it is your book does an excellent job at a lot of the what kind of questions. So what games are for the system and how good were these games? You have a lot of really interesting commentary on the different qualities of the different games as a player, from the sort of player experience. But it doesn't go, and it goes into a little bit of the how, like there's a fair amount of some of the history there, but I would say a lot less so on the why kind of questions. Mm-hmm. Why does this thing even exist, or why was it done in the first place? What were the creators trying to even achieve? So we try to provide a much deeper context for it and kind of try to give an overview of some of the cool things about the system in this broader context of entertainment media, in this broader context of games. I think a lot of games history books focus on the facts. Like this machine had this many megabits and this many, you know, this processor, which is this fast, and this game had this many sprites and that stuff is super important, really relevant. I think what our book does, and other books in Platform Study Series too, is we'll sort of step back and say, well, why are we using sprites in the first place? Like where did that come from? Why did it come? We know who invented this. We know where they were working and what constraints they were under. But how do we kind of tell a broader narrative of everything coming together? I think of the Virtual Boy, I realized that there were lots of interesting narratives kind of woven in together that speak to games more broadly as well. We have a whole chapter examining, well, this idea of the gimmick, right? And what is a gimmick? What makes something a gimmick? And is a gimmick a good thing or a bad thing? And we sort of look at the Virtual Boy under that lens, but we're also saying something broad about just gimmicks and video games in general and how central they are to video game culture and games as a technology as well.
My favorite part of the book, well, I might be derailing your question. I do feel like it's your book, Jeremy, and ours are very complementary, and they don't compete at all, in my opinion, because our book is very, very academic, and it's very, you know, just like everything Jose said, it considers different angles in a different type of way. And we are very thankful that yours came first, because, you know, like you had engaged me to create that gallery in your book before, and that had familiarized me more with the games. And I create a bunch of screenshots, and we used some of the outtakes of the screenshots in our book because I had already taken them, and like, why do it again? But
sure.
Anyway, it was great. But I wanted to say my favorite part of what Jose did in this book is like, you know, discovering this lineage of peep boxes spans back hundreds of years and putting with, you know, discovering the layered diorama style. He's like named it that on the Virtual Boy, and just putting the Virtual Boy in this context of, you know, devices you peer into. I think that's absolutely fascinating. And when he, you know, approached me with that idea, I said, man, you're really onto something. You need to really follow this down. And so that's really, I think that's a cool angle.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, having spent the better part of a year immersed in this system, writing about it, playing the games, creating videos, I've come away from, you know, what I've read of the book, having learned a lot that I had never considered. Not only facts about the system, but just, you know, the history behind it and kind of the philosophy behind it. And I have to ask, first, I don't know if you'd like to talk about a few of those things, but secondly, like, how do you develop these thoughts? Are they, you know, kind of informed speculation? Are you doing research and drawing lines, or are you actually kind of picking up threads from things that some of the creators have actually said?
So I'd say yes to all of the above. Obviously, a lot of it is sort of playing the games and thinking about them. A lot of it is also looking at other scholarly work in the area and kind of, I'm not sure if it's from Dominic Arsenault's platform study on the Super Nintendo or from Nathan's platform study on the NES, and maybe both of them. They sort of talk about like the marketing side and how the device was sold. And so that got me thinking, well, I wonder how this device was sold. How was it presented? We talk about the advertising behind it and what Nintendo was trying to do with that. So that became another theme in the book. They also talk about the sort of the gimmick thing. That idea is also present, though not fully developed in the case of the NES, because for the NES, it was more of a, the robot particular was the analysis that Nathan does in his book about the, when the NES was brought to the US, they sort of added this robot to camouflage the fact that it's a game console. And as soon as the console took off, the robot disappeared pretty quickly from the scene. And so that's basically, you're sort of connecting different ideas and saying, okay, well, there's a pattern here, right? It's the same company. They're the same basic philosophy. Did some reading up on Gunpei Yokoi. I bought a couple of books in Japanese that I then had translated, where they're interviewing Yokoi, and he talks about his philosophy and design and sort of threads the needle between what he'd done with the Game & Watch and the Game Boy. And obviously they go, well, I guess it's the same thing with the Virtual Boy. in the scholarly side, there's a whole area of a whole discipline called game studies, where a lot of people are studying and looking at games seriously. But you can also look at sort of media archaeology, people looking at old forms of entertainment, old forms of media. And that got me thinking, well, there is something to this. Like, what, stereoscopy, when did stereoscopy start? How did it become to be developed as a technology? So I'm starting to read other scholars and things they talked about. So it really is a process of learning and reading and studying and researching and then trying to see if there are dots that need to be connected or not. And that's where bouncing ideas off of Benj and Benj giving feedback was a big part of that process. I sort of, I say, well, I just saw this article about this thing. And then he says, oh yeah. And Benj was like, oh yeah, well, this connects to this other thing. I, you know, thought about that. Like, well, no, I hadn't. So that really is the process of sort of trying to form a coherent, line of thought. In our case, multiple different, each chapter has like a different theme, a different, perspective that we're exploring, but figuring out which are the ones that make the most sense, which are the ones that are most interesting, I think is that's just part of the process of doing the research.
Yeah, I think something came to mind, which is that another favorite part of the book that was sort of a discovery that came out of research for me was when we decided to explain how stereoscopy works, like, you know, with your eyes and your brain and stuff like that, and in a little bit of technical detail, medical almost. And I learned stuff, like, I think I began that section myself, like, by doing research into medical literature and stuff. And I discovered the horopter thing, which is like this imaginary line where anything past it is farther away and anything closer to it is looks nearer, and you have to have a relative object in the middle to even see depth, which is crazy. And it's funny to me that, like, in developing the system, Nintendo had to figure that stuff out and figure out, like, some fundamental things about how the human brain perceives depth so that they could manipulate it and trick you into seeing it the right way, and then inform the developers of games how to make them work that way, you know, and given the limitations of the system, with like mostly flat sprites placed at different places, and like, how do you, you know, move those pieces around or combine them together in a way that's very entertaining, you know, depth wise. And, our book goes into a lot of that, which is really fun.
Did you, I haven't, like I said, finished the book yet. Did you get into sort of the modern trend of HD 2D games that we've seen, like Octopath Traveler and that sort of thing, where it kind of creates, you know, the idea of, it's not true 3D visualization, but it uses that sort of depth of field to kind of create a sense of, you know, bokeh and sort of like you're playing a game filled with miniatures in a tiny little stage. Because I feel like that's sort of accomplishing with just standard technology what Virtual Boy attempted to do with dedicated technology.
It's interesting. I think that, and I think there's also, this is a sort of similar concept to that tilt shift photography stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? Tilt where shift, you get these, yeah tilt shift, yeah. Where you get these pictures that look like little models. I hadn't thought about that at the, you know, when we're working about, I'm not sure that was quite in vogue yet.
It might not have come out yet when we were working on it. I don't remember what year it came out.
But it would be a great addition for a second edition of the book, basically, to incorporate that. Because I think it fits nicely with a theme, which is, like, over human history, we've always had this interest in looking at things differently and sort of altering our visual perception. And I think that tilt-shift photography stuff, I think, aligns perfectly with that. You know, make a thing that looks like a little toy when it isn't quite a toy. So yeah, I think that's a really good insight, and we did not make that connection in the book, so we don't end on that either. But it definitely fits in with, I mean, I think that'll always be a thing in video games, right? Is sort of altering people's perception of what's on the screen and playing around with that in cool and different ways, for sure.
Oh yeah, I thought of something. There's another thing for the second edition, Jose, which is Super Mario Wonder. As soon as I played Super Mario Wonder and saw that the Mario goes into like a pipe or something and comes out in the background on two different layers, just like Virtual Boy Wario Land, I immediately messaged Jose and we're like, wow, this is amazing. It's just like Wario Land. So, cause we thought we used that as an example of, using the technology in the gaming, you know, like showing the depth. It's fun that Nintendo's finally come back to that idea.
Yeah, it's interesting because other developers have kind of run with that idea, usually in portable games. But I know Shantae Risky's Revenge had that element where you could go from the foreground into the background. And then once the 3DS came out, what's the name of the company? I just totally blanked on it. The Jules Watson's company created a sort of little compact Metroidvania called Zeo Drifter. And it reuses the 3DS's, you know, kind of visual staging to do exactly that, where you kind of disappear into the distance and you're like this little guy running around in the background doing all the stuff you do in the foreground, but it's just small, tiny. So yeah, it is interesting that it's taken this long for Nintendo to pull that back in, because I can't think of an example of a 2D Nintendo developed game that made use of that Wario Land feature while everyone else was out there saying, oh, that's a cool idea, let's borrow that.
The closest thing I remember, which is really not the same thing, is like in Minish Cap, when you go through a tube and you become tiny. It's not foreground, background, but somehow that reminds me of it.
Yeah, that's more Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I guess to be fair, there's the, and we talk about this in the book, the one of the Mario games where you're on these panels that you can flip and now you're up on the other side. So it does have that foreground, background, but the foreground, background are really close together. So it's almost there in a way.
I'd love to see Super Mario World like done in a Virtual Boy style, you know, like play it out with the layers and in with depth like you, that you see. That would be fun.
Jeremy here with a quick message from our sponsor, Squarespace. Just a couple of days ago, I saw an article claiming that 38% of websites that existed before 2013 no longer exist online. I kind of feel like I personally account for a big chunk of that percentage. None of the personal sites I created or professional sites I helmed more than a decade ago are around anymore. They've all fallen victims to the realities of the internet, purchased and dismantled by hungry equity capitalists, or maybe just vanished due to the difficulty of renewing an SSL certificate for domains that have circulated through multiple registrars and even more hosts. So, sorry about that. But I'm trying to put things right. In my spare time lately, I've been tinkering with a Squarespace account, building a new personal domain for the things that I find important. That's not going to bring back a decade of professional writing that's been trapped eternally inaccessible in a legacy corporate database, but it's something, or it will be once it's ready. Squarespace wants to help you, too. They've lowered the barriers to entry for creating an attractive, well-organized, interesting site. Their Squarespace Blueprint guided design system makes layout a breeze, with drag-and-drop convenience and customization that enable responsive design. It looks good on every platform, whether you're working in text, images, or embedded video content. Squarespace can also help you get up and running if you want to set up an online shop, with fully integrated commerce options like email campaigns and flexible payment plan through PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit cards. But Squarespace is not just for businesses. It's also great for personal work and passion projects like mine, too. My site's not ready for prime time yet, but I can't wait to show you what I've been working on. And when you're ready to push back against the disappearance of real human voices on the internet, get things rolling at squarespace.com. Head over now to give it a spin with a free trial. And once you're ready to launch, go to www.squarespace.com/retro to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/retro. Let's bring back the internet, one website at a time. Well, one of the things I didn't realize, you know, even after playing all the way through Wario Land on Virtual Boy, is just the amount of depth and detail that was put into constructing the graphics. Like, I just kind of see those as, oh yeah, it's got a Wario sprite. But you guys went into a lot of depth about just how complex the character sprites and elements like that are, and how there's all these independently functional elements on separate layers that it's done so subtly you don't even really notice. Like, how did you even kind of come to that realization? Because it's not something that I had seen, you know, as I played.
I think this is a place where we have to recognize and shout out and express our admiration and thanks to the Virtual Boy fan community. This has been the goldmine for a lot of the information that we talked about in the book. And there's different people that have gone into the ROMs and unpacked them and tried to find the sprites for certain characters. And then realize, wait a minute, there is no single sprite. What is happening? And then thanks to the fans who put together emulators can basically see, figure out, okay, how's this sprite actually working? Like, how is this picture that I'm seeing on the emulator window running around? Where are the graphical parts for coming together and how are they being assembled? So, a lot of our analysis is basically, we're basically saying, look, here's what someone else found. And we're just like kind of explaining it in a simplified way. So I don't want to take any credit for those insights. Those insights come from the fan community, and we do acknowledge them in the book, and whether sometimes just a username, that's all we have to go on.
Yes, I saw some interesting
citations.
pizza roll something or another.
Yep.
Yeah, I was like, that's definitely someone on the internet that they don't know their actual identity.
There's a Virtual Boy Discord that has a lot of great people in it who were very helpful. Like a guy named Guy Perfect was helped me with a lot of technical stuff when I started to explain how the how the hell does the Virtual Boy do different colors, like shades of red, and like what are the limitations of that? There was nothing written down on the internet or anywhere in any documentation that explained that. And so he, being someone who has developed some homebrew stuff himself, explained the limitations and how there's a certain number of shades, and some of them you can't even perceive the difference between them. So there's no fixed number of colors you can quantify, which is crazy. So yeah,
it's kind of like how the NES doesn't have an actual palette. It's just, how does your television display the graphics? Those are the colors for the NES.
I love that about video games and everything else. When you have something that can't be quantified and it's so subjective, and because it really pisses some people off who love specs and stats and stuff, but it shows how messy the world is and how analog we really are. And everything digital is just an abstraction of analog technology underneath. Anyway.
Yeah, we even sent some of the drafts of the chapters to members of the community just to make sure that we weren't sort of totally off base with some things we were saying, for some of the technical details of the hardware, especially. It's like, hey, we're explaining this works this way. Does that track? And then we get feedback. So, well, actually, technically, you know, this is happening. So things happening. So they were invaluable, not only a source of information, but also as a source of sort of verification to make sure that we weren't just, you know, misinterpreting or misunderstanding or misexplaining a bunch of things.
That's much better than my approach, which is to try to come to an understanding of things based on what I read and watch, and then process that and present it, and then wait for people to come into the YouTube comments and say, no, that's not right. I mean, there is, you know, I guess it's community vetting, but it's a less responsible approach than you took. But yeah, that is a, like the visual element of, you know, the degrees of tones is something that I wasn't able to capture in my book, because I was capturing, you know, an RGB output, basically tapping the video feed before it reached the lenses of the Virtual Boy headset, because it's really difficult to capture Virtual Boy images from the lens. I mean, I did my damnedest, and I got a few okay photographs with a macro lens, but even those it was tough. So, you know, I basically captured what looked like extremely chunky, high resolution Game Boy graphics in grayscale, which is, you know, a part of the process, but it's not how the Virtual Boy actually output its images to the human eye when you look at it through the screen. But yeah, you just can't present those. What is it? 128 different intensities for each shade or something like that?
I can't remember. I know there's like some, I just reread that chapter last night, so I should remember this. But yeah, I remember something like 127 or 128, but there are more potential ones. And that's sort of, I think that was like the bounds of what's potentially perceivable. And the palette is four shades, and one of them is always black or transparent, and one of them is like the most intense, and the other two, they're all related because one of the colors is like a sum of the other two, and so it's just sort of messy, like it's all linked together. But the whole display thing, how the display works and how they figured out how to display a stable image is amazing to me, because, you know, I just recalled some of that because I was just reading it again. You know, it's been a couple of years since we wrote it, but I was refreshing in my mind and there's like an angular velocity thing, because there's a mirror pivoting on a stick, basically, back and forth, and it's reflecting the light to paint it into your retinas, basically. And because of the angular velocity or something like that, and the duration of when these LED things are lit, the pixels would not all be square, like if you didn't adjust it. So they have to adjust, you know, the duration of how each one is lit depending on where it is in the grid to make them all appear square. And since LEDs are on or off, and they don't deal with intensity in terms of an analog voltage. They have just how long they pulse them on and off to deal with the intensity. So there's all these calculations going on all the time just to paint this image. And it's just incredible, like the detail and all the work put into developing it, and the work Nintendo did to take the technology Reflection made and turn it into a game console. And then Wario Land is definitely the most complex game with the most detail into it. Like you said, with there's some of the sprites are, you know, I'll explain if you haven't read the book, you know, one of the ways the Virtual Boy can display depth is you give it a sprite and you give it like a Z index that basically controls the depth of how you perceive it. And then so it's like one sprite and it automatically adjusts how far away it looks. And then there's another way of doing it, which is having two graphics for one sprite that are just always, you know, have that difference built into the pixels. And so, like, there's an example in the book of one of the blocks has a little smiley face or something that's, you know, slightly off. So it just adds just a little bit more depth to that. Instead of just being one flat sprite that's in one spot, there's another thing popping out a little bit from it. You know, the face is popping off of it. And there's, I think was it Wario's eyeball is a little bit weird or something like that. So there's it's just incredible the amount of work they put into it. And I wish that Nintendo had, you know, if this had been a more viable platform, and, you know, I'd love to see what really creative and well-funded game developers could do with this thing, you know.
Yeah, and it's a pity Nintendo has never revisited the system. My understanding from talking to people who have the inside track with, you know, people at Nintendo is that the company really sees Virtual Boy as a failure, and it did sort of flirt with the history of Virtual Boy a little bit when it first launched 3DS. But I think once 3DS kind of found its own footing, they backed away from that for the most part. And yeah. So they've really sort of just kind of,
I think
they prefer to just put the kibosh on it.
I hate the fact that they think of it as a failure. And my article in 2015 was written to Nintendo. Like, half of it is aimed at Nintendo. Like, look at what you've done. Your legacy is nothing to be ashamed of. This is cool. And so I was purposely thinking about the audience of people at Nintendo reading this. I sent it to Reggie Fils-Aimé after I wrote it and probably asked him to interview for it or something, because I actually asked him, can I talk to some of these people who worked on the Virtual Boy? One of them worked for Nintendo of America, and they put me through, and the person wasn't interested in talking or something like that. So that didn't come to pass, but I did want to send that message to Nintendo to look at this, like, embrace this part of your legacy, because it's something to be proud of that you took this risk, did something innovative and interesting. And I think there's no shame in it. And we found a way to recontextualize it, that quote unquote failure. And it was very key in this quote we found from Shigeru Miyamoto, where in one of the Iwata Asks interviews, they were talking about the Virtual Boy in the context of developing the 3DS, I think. And Shigeru Miyamoto says something like, well, you know, it sold 770,000 consoles, which is a horrible failure for a Nintendo console, which would sell tens of millions or more, whatever. But if we had marketed it as a toy, you know, like a scary stereoscopic toy, it would have been a success. So it's just all based on the context of how you look at it. And I think we examine, you know, Nintendo's marketing failure of how they position this thing, you know, to fail, basically, because there's two things. Virtual and boy are both bad words here, because virtual links it to virtual reality, which it's not. Boy links it to the Game Boy lineage, which it's not. I mean, you're putting the Game Boy is like hundreds of millions of units, like one of the most successful portable gaming platforms ever. So you're positioning this thing as like maybe a successor to the Game Boy or a complement or something like that, which it's a fairly poor portable machine because it's linked to a table stand and you can't strap it on your face. And it's also compromised because they thought of it as a portable machine first, and then because of liability issues, they had to scale it back and take it off your face and things like that. And it was too late to give it more power that you could, you know, if you knew it was going to be on a table and you could give it more power or something, it could have had a better chipset and maybe done some better, like polygons, something like that. But so it was just this weird compromise, and it would have been a perfect gimmick toy instead of, you know, a new Nintendo gaming platform, I think.
I think it'll still go down in history as a bigger success than Apple Vision Pro.
You think so?
I do think so. But no, actually, I was about to talk about the marketing and how, you know, the name of the system itself ties it to virtual reality and Game Boy. But you already did that, so
Sorry.
No, that's great. That's one of the things that jumped out to me reading through the book is like you guys did a really great job of sort of pulling those components apart and saying, you know, like here's kind of the perception, here's the history of the things that Virtual Boy seemed to tie into, at least based on its name and its marketing, but that it's really not a part of, like that's not really relevant to what the system was.
That's what makes the system so weird and interesting. And so Jose's discovered that the developers honed in on this style, the layered diorama, because of what they had to work with, you know, which it wouldn't have happened any other way. If it was like more powerful, you probably would have had like a Super Mario World or a Doom or something on there. I mean, Super Mario 64 type game, sorry. And if it were virtual reality and you could look around, you know, you wouldn't be stuck with this viewport of one game in a certain way. And they thought of, let's make it like you're looking at a play on a stage or in through a peep box or something, you know, because you're stuck looking at this thing. And you know, it is related to virtual reality in the sense that it is stereoscopic. That's the only way I'd say, you know, so in the lineage of stereoscopic devices, it's somewhere in there because VR headsets use stereoscopy, but they're not the same because there's no head tracking and you're not like immersing yourself into a virtual space necessarily. And I don't know. I'm just going on. Jose, what do you want to say about this?
I think I can't say that Nintendo, I think Nintendo's in a really tough spot, right? They were a tough spot because they were late to the game with the sort of next main console, right? So the N64 was, air quotes, just around the corner for too long, right? PlayStation had just come out and was sort of taking off and being wildly successful. And so they've got this other device that they're trying to get out there, and they're kind of spinning too many plates is the way I think about it. So they put enough effort into the Virtual Boy to get it out there. I think the marketing team did all things considered, did a really good job in the sense of, well, how do we explain this device when if we say it's 3D, people can imagine it's 3D like polygons, but that's not what we're doing here, right? That's 3D as a buzzword was hot at that time. It was a really hot buzzword. We got people talking about 3D all over the place, and everything you'd add 3D to any game, that meant like, no, it was like the game of the future. The virtual fighter games, for example, were hot in the arcades, had these early, polygon characters that like, looked terrible, but were cool just because they were polygons, right? Not sprites. And so they have this device, which is stereoscopic, but it's basically sprite based. And so you're kind of stuck. Well, how do we explain this in such a way that people who are out there will both get excited and understand what it is? And so they hit on this campaign, which I think was a smart idea. Right. And as far as we know from the press releases we looked at and so on, it was successful in getting the word out. It's just that people weren't super excited about the device in the end. Right. So they ran this marketing campaign with Blockbuster. We could go to Blockbuster and rent a Virtual Boy, for the weekend. And if you think about this context, imagine that, PlayStation 5 is announced and you're not sure you want to buy it. You can go to your local Target or your Best Buy and rent one for the weekend. That's something that would be inconceivable nowadays, right? For any sort of mainline console that you could actually try it first for a couple of days before committing to buying it is a completely alien idea. And yet Nintendo said, yeah, we're going to do this with a Virtual Boy because it's such a different device that we really think people need to try it so they understand it. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they were really doing their best, I think. And yes, the name is unfortunate, and perhaps the marketing team was like, well, that's the name it is. We're stuck with it. But you never know. I mean, it's also one of those. I remember when the Nintendo Wii was announced, and people were like, that's the dumbest name ever. Like, who calls their console the Wii? Like, and all kinds of memes and jokes about that. And yet somehow it went on to, sell trillions with, again, a really smart marketing campaign, which sort of emphasized not what was happening on the screen, but what was happening in the living room for the case of the Wii. And so they were trying to do the same thing. Like they had earlier tried to do the same thing with a Virtual Boy. So I think that's where our analysis of like what was going on in games and technology and entertainment media in the mid 90s, I think sort of really helps kind of illustrate the tight spot that Nintendo was in with this particular device, right? Because everything was up in the air that time. People did not know what the future was going to be in terms of entertainment. Is it going to be the internet? Yes. Is it going to be multimedia? Yes. Is it going to be 3D? Yes. Is it going to be all these things? Is one of these going to win? When is it going to die? We don't know. I think we made a list of all the major consoles that came out within 3 years of the Virtual Boy. And it wasn't three consoles like we think of nowadays. It's like, oh, there's three companies, three consoles. It was like 8 or 10 consoles. Mm-hmm. And most of those like disappeared, right? And that's a kind of sign of how unstable, uncertain what the future was at that going to be like at that moment in time. Things are moving so fast and in so many different directions. It sort of breaks a narrative of, oh, everything is a console generation where maybe it's just more megabytes, more graphics, more color, faster processes, and so on. Right. It kind of really illustrates the fact that no, things aren't set in stone or predetermined in that way. And the Virtual Boy could have been a hit. Right. It could have been a huge hit. And then all of a sudden there's like an entire new category of games. There's portables and consoles and there's Virtual Boys, like Virtual Boy clones that may maybe have turned into like some new genre of entertainment. Now, nowadays we have VR. VR was hot then too. VR could have been the future and all the other consoles could have died. It could have been VR. Right. So I don't know. I mean, I it's always easy to armchair and go like, well, they should have done this. They should have done that. Or these are like issues of, I think we highlight all the issues and concerns, but I think it's fair to say, well, you just made a mistake and this is what you should have done instead. Because really at that moment in time, you sort of travel back and think of the stuff and the stuff you didn't know back then. Like, I don't know that they could have done that much better other than, yeah, keep on funding it for a while and hopefully Nintendo 64 will come out just right. And that's the kind of stuff we don't really know for sure. What was going on inside Nintendo at that time? What were they thinking? Where were they feeling the squeeze in terms of their own budget and their time and so on?
It's interesting, talking about the layered diorama and everything. There was really only one Virtual Boy game that presented 3D in the way that we think of it now, which was Red Alarm, which used wireframes.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that wonders if the system had stuck around longer and people had gotten more of a handle on how it worked, I wonder if, you know, the approach that Sega took with Saturn might have worked for Virtual Boy, because Saturn doesn't really render its games as polygons. It presents them as sprites that it then distorts and reshapes so that it looks three-dimensional. But it's not the traditional triangular polygons that we think of, you know, kind of the ones that kind of won the technology war. And I wonder if Virtual Boy might have had enough oomph to do something along those lines, maybe, you know, fewer sprites to be distorted, no texturing and things like that. But I feel like, you know, if you present something that's kind of in the style of Sega Saturn, but has that actual 3D visualization, that could have been, I feel like it could have been a real killer app for the system, where people look in and they see, you know, kind of what they expected from virtual reality. Or if maybe that was just beyond the capabilities of the system, which was the equivalent of, God, what console was it? Was it the Bandai Playdia? Or PCFX, that's what it was, yeah. So kind of a console that was made for streaming video, more or less, and sprite-based graphics.
So the wisdom from the fan community, because this is a question that I did ask some of the members of that community directly, is that, yeah, basically hardware wasn't there to really do good, fast polygons. The architecture, basically, the way the system architected was not good for polygons. And to this day, you know, there's fans that have been trying to do things and so on. Maybe some really smart genius person can figure out a cool trick that no one has thought of before, which is definitely a thing that does happen in video games all the time. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that in the Atari 2600, which I learned about from Racing the Beam. So I don't want to say that it's impossible, but the architecture of the hardware was definitely not well suited for polygons, and definitely puts a pretty hard ceiling on what it could do. It's just in terms of the speed, because at the end of the day, you need to think the hardware was not cutting edge at that time, and it was also having to basically render two displays at the same time. So anything that, you know, double speed means now you have to have the speed on anything. What I'm actually more curious and would like to know if the whole, like, how much further could they push the sprite stuff, right? So the Super Nintendo was doing some really cool stuff by the end of that cycle. And there's other consoles at that time which were really pushing, like, sprite stuff. And I think the added, you know, stereo part might have made for some really interesting, compelling games that we didn't quite get the chance to see because there wasn't enough time for people to wrap their heads around the hardware and really push it to its limit. I think that's where WiiWare kind of shines, because it kind of shows this. It's the same Nintendo people who are basically like, yeah, things we've learned in all these other Mario games, now we're going like a little incremental steps, adding more layers and some rotations and some cool stuff like that. So I think that's where the hardware really does shine in some sense, and that's where its perhaps most unexplored potential lies, is in kind of really do cool stuff with sprites and stereo. And I think that's why we talk about the layer diorama as kind of this, like, this is what this thing is capable of doing really well, and they explored it well. Could they have done a layer diorama plus? Like, what does that plus version look like? That's what I'm curious to find out.
I was just thinking the other day, it'd be fun if you could stick some kind of 3D chip in a cartridge and augment it, its capabilities, processing capabilities, with some kind of coprocessor, which probably was not possible in 1995, but you might be able to do it now, and that would be fun. And
well, you could then, right? Because that's what the FX chip, right?
On yeah.
The,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the Super Nintendo's, a couple of cards that came out with a special chip on the card itself to do the, basically to handle the 3D essentially. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they could have done that for the Virtual Boy, but you sort of wonder, wasn't this device supposed to do stereo? Now you've added, like, a sharp to do, like, more stereo or polygon stereo. I don't know. I mean, it's also possible. I mean, maybe that would have been there could have been a Virtual Boy 2, right? With double the RAM and maybe double the speed, the process speed, that could have pulled it off.
Virtual teen.
Well, it would have had to be color too or something. Yeah. I want to mention something that this, like, the misperceptions of the console, it's not just marketing's fault, because, like, there's these fundamental limitations of how the technology works, like the fact that the whole thing is red and it's monochrome. And it's, to this day, people just do not understand why it was red and why it wasn't color. Every time I post something about the Virtual Boy online, they're like, man, they almost had it if they just had a color display or something. And, you know, to do a color display at that time, you would have probably had to have, you know, I guess there were some LCDs and stuff that weren't, but, you know, a lot of the big headsets, like Virtuality's headset, had little CRTs in it, I'm pretty sure, which made the headset huge and, you know, heavy and power hungry, you know. So as far as having a small portable display at that time in a consumer product you could sell for $200, you know, is like, yeah, they used red LEDs. But still, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, Jose, while we were developing the book, but I want to look into the psychological effects of actually seeing red. Like, red is like a warning, a danger sign, you know, and it's for arousal and anger and everything, yeah, you know. And so, like, this is like maybe the worst color they could have possibly used, you know, for an impression on people. Because maybe if it was just black and white, like a Game Boy, like literally gray, or, you know, white and gray, maybe it wouldn't have been such a, I don't know, maybe people could have looked past it. But when it's red, it's like, why red? Why not something else? But gray, people, you know, are used to black and white TV. So maybe they could have accepted it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. And unfortunately for them, that's where LED technology sort of wasn't quite there yet for the Virtual Boy. It was the red LEDs that were the super cheap ones. And I think blue LEDs had been invented maybe a couple of years prior to that. So we're definitely
very expensive.
Yeah, they were not at a price point that Nintendo was like, yeah, just like slap a bunch of them in this console and we're good to go. So if the story were like, well, okay, we can pick one LED and we can use, you know, red or green or white, then maybe they would have chosen a different color and the story could be different.
And if I'm not mistaken, white LEDs are just red, green, and blue LEDs mixed together. I'm not completely positive about that, but at least the early ones were. So you would have had to have all three of them just to make a white LED at the time.
It's even more expensive then.
Yeah. Maybe you could use a tiny little light bulb. I don't know. But it wouldn't have been an array and it would have been a lot more.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine getting like a pair of Lynx screens or Game Gear screens in there with the ghosting and the lag and the expense. Yeah, the battery consumption. Not a good way to go. So yeah, LED was the way they had to do it. But anyway, Jose, I know you have a hard out and you need to take off. So we need to wrap here. But thank you both for your time. Please tell us once again where we can find your book, what it's called, and who's selling it.
Sure. So the book is called Seeing Red, Nintendo's Virtual Boy, published by MIT Press. You can find it at all major booksellers and retailers, including the big ones that I'm reticent to name, but I think y'all know which ones I'm talking about. You can also just go straight to the MIT Press website, and I'm sure they have links there as well.
All right. I won't do the Retronauts outro because this is not long enough to qualify for a full episode, so I'll have another segment at the end. But I would like for both of you to tell us where we can find you and your work online if you choose to make yourself public.
Sure. I'm still on Twitter, and I still call it Twitter, at Jose Zagal, JoseZagal. You can also just Google me. If you come up with someone who's a chemist, that's not me, that's my dad. If it's video games, then that's me. I've got a presence in lots of different places. Google Scholar would be, if you want to read some of my other scholarly work as well.
And Benj?
Yep, I'm on Twitter/X as Benj Edwards, and you can find my works currently at either vintagecomputing.com. I just actually posted a few new features there in the last month, which is fascinating for the first time in a long time, and on arstechnica.com. So look me up. And there's some, you know, three or four different Virtual Boy articles I've written over the years out there, so you can Google those too.
All right. Thank you both for your time. Congratulations on the book. I'm looking forward to finishing it. But it's been, you know, even as someone, like I said, who spent a year immersed in Virtual Boy and really dug into the system and its library, it's been a learning experience, and it's been cool to get these different perspectives on it. So I highly recommend this volume to everyone.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Appreciate the invite.
week in Retronauts, we're going to make you read to succeed. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, hosting this week. And with me here, we have a couple of people who are invested in your success. They have written books so that you can read them and you can succeed, as the saying goes. These are both guys that I've worked with under the auspices of my day job at Limited Run Games Press Run. And so this episode is a little self-serving for me, but not really, because I've done my part with these books. I helped put them together and worked with the guys to get everything published. And now it's really just to kind of draw some attention to the fine work that they've published and the stories they have to tell, both of which are, of course, relevant to classic video gaming history. And these guys that I have with me here are kind of come at things from very different directions. One is someone who has worked in the video games industry and spent, you know, what would you say, like 15 years ish?
Plus, yeah.
Yeah, working in production throughout the 80s and 90s into the 2000s. And the other guy, as far as I know, you haven't worked in the video games industry,
not.
But you've contributed a lot to, in my opinion, to kind of building awareness of esoteric details from the Japanese side of things.
I hope so.
And bringing things into English that have been very useful for people like me who do a lot of research and writing. So, like I said, two different angles, two different backgrounds, but both with valuable stories to tell. And I'm happy to say that those stories are enshrined in print, so they can never be destroyed. They're there permanently. They're on the permanent record. So first, I'll let you guys introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about your backgrounds. We'll start with you, Mark, since your book came out first.
Hi, I'm Mark Flipman. I had a long career in video games. I started in film production in Chicago, went into video games, worked at companies like Mindscape, Konami, Acclaim, Atari, Midway, kind of lived on both coasts and in the Chicagoland area, and worked on just a wide variety of genres and titles and enjoyed it. And now I find out that the generation that was playing my games is old enough to be interested in reliving their childhood mm-hmm. and getting a hold of me. And it's been a nice ride.
Brian, what about yourself?
I'm Brian Clark. I run the site 1millionpower.com, which over the years has done a lot of translations on, how would you put it? I guess like Jeremy said, it's more been video game ephemera, Japanese developer interviews and that sort of things. But as opposed to interviews with, you know, people everyone knows like Shigeru Miyamoto, I tend to pick a little bit more obscure people to delve into slightly more niche topics. I've also listened to Japanese music for quite a few years, and there's a little bit more intersection between those two topics than you think, and that's kind of what the book I put out really emphasizes more than anything else.
Yeah, so Mark, let's start by talking a little bit about your book, It's Not All Fun and Games. Just, you know, kind of from the top level, how would you give just a quick pitch to someone if you're trying to convince them that they need a copy of this book in their lives?
Well, it was kind of a multi-goal endeavor. I wanted to document my career. I started to do that for my girls so that they'd be able to see what their dad did. And then I started to get more and more detailed. And then I wanted it to be entertaining. I wanted it to be educational so that if somebody either wanted to know details about the video game industry or maybe get into it, I try to have some little tips that I learned along the way, because there's always something you learn at every company that's different. And I wanted to document what I did and make sure that, because I knew I was writing a book about video games and toys, that there was a lot of pictures, because people that play video games or love toys don't necessarily want a book that's just text. They want to be able to see something.
We're visually oriented.
Exactly. So, but if you're interested in any of the companies that I mentioned. In at Konami, I worked on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Pirates, King's Quest, Carmen Sandiego, Mission Impossible, Simpsons. Acclaim was wrestling, more Simpsons, Marvel. I worked on sports titles like NFL Blitz and MLB Slugfest. I worked on anime titles like Dragon Ball Z and Zoids, and so among others. But mm-hmm. it's a kind of a wide variety, and I know there's a lot of fans of a lot of those titles, so it'd probably be a good read. I try to write it for the common person so that I can explain things in detail if they needed to know.
Well, Brian just said that, you know, when he focuses on doing translations of articles and interviews on Japanese developers, he likes to kind of go away from the sort of known public faces of companies and talk to people who are more on the nuts and bolts side of things. And I feel that's what's really great about your book, is that it's very much about the nuts and bolts of game production and game development. It's not, you know, like a John Romero or Shigeru Miyamoto sitting back and saying, like, here's my inspirations and, you know, here's what it was like creating this one game that everyone knows and loves. It was more about, your book is more about, you know, here are the processes. Here is what my role was in helping to get these games out the door. Here's how I worked directly with the developers. Here's how I had to deal with company politics and things like that. And it, you know, I haven't really read another book, and I've read a lot of books about video games, that really kind of gets into that side of things and just talks about, you know, some of the more mundane details of making video games, because it is a business. It's, you know, like, I think people have this vision of making video games in their heads. It's just like you're always doing super mm-hmm. cool stuff, and it's just, you know, nonstop pizza parties, but... then you hear about things like, you know, all the crunch that the crunch time people have to commit. And so there's this kind of disparity. And I feel like It's Not All Fun and Games does a pretty good job of sort of connecting those dots and saying, like, here is, you know, Mortal Kombat, a game that I was involved in. Here's how I was involved. And here's, you know, kind of what was happening behind the scenes with the team divisions and, you know, kind of figuring out who would work on this and what the process was for getting it marketed and so on and so forth. And you just, yeah, you don't really see a lot of that. So it's a really, in my opinion, really valuable kind of document of how video games worked, especially, you know, like 20, 30 years ago. I don't know if they necessarily work the same way now, but it did, you know, kind of fill in some gaps for me, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I think the creative process is, there's always similarities, no matter what year, what age. Marketing changes, of course. I mean, in those days, there wasn't mobile phones. Mm-hmm. And now that's a whole huge gaming industry in itself. So things change. But I think the process, the creative process, is usually pretty similar. And but every company's different, which is something I learned. And I think that was one of the unique things about me thinking, well, maybe people want to hear about this, is you go to one company and maybe even you're successful and you think, oh, this is the way they do it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the next company and you go, whoa, this is completely different. So it's a learning process.
Yeah, I think that comes out pretty early in your book, actually. Just talking about your time at Mindscape, where you kind of got your start, and then your time at Konami after that. And, you know, just the roles you played and the way those companies were organized is radically different. Like, Konami was and still is very top-down from the Japanese home office. And so I feel like people on the U.S. side and the European side just kind of get their marching orders. And, you know, the decisions are sort of issued forth from the Japanese office, whereas Mindscape was much more like, hey, here's some people who are working in Australia. Can you go fly over there and, you know, see what they're up to and just kind of keep that on track? Yeah, thanks. Go do that. It just seemed like, my impression, at least from your text, was that it was much more like you had a lot more autonomy. And I wouldn't say it was laissez-faire, but, you know, you were kind of given a lot of trust and kind of authority to make things happen. And I don't think you would have gotten that at a company like Konami that's bigger and, you know, again, kind of organized in that top-down approach.
Absolutely. And every, like we said, every company is different. Some companies do give you a lot more leeway or trust. And Acclaim was one of those companies where there were three producers and each one of us handled one-third of the company's products. And they just said, you know, if you have like Marvel, you're always going to have a Marvel title you're working on. So if when one's done, come up with the next one. What do you want to do it on? What's the subject matter? And you just do it. And you'd find the developer. But one of the big things I was shocked at in my career was the difference between internal and external development teams. And I tried to point that out in the book. Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be much easier with an internal team because you're there. You're there every day. You get to see what they're doing, and it's great. Mm-hmm. External, you have to kind of communicate, visit them, see where they're at. But the one thing I completely forgot about with internal teams is, with external teams, you're in charge of paying them. When they hit their milestone, you pay them. With internal teams, they're salaried. They don't care. They're going to get paid whether they hit their milestone or do what you ask them. So it was real culture shock when I got into a company that had internal teams, which I was looking forward to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't want people to misunderstand what you're saying when you say that the internal teams don't care. What you mean, if you don't mind me speaking for you, is that they are less concerned about, you know, those milestones and keeping to the schedule than they are. You know, I think in my experience talking to people who work on internal development teams, they just want to make something awesome. And they tend not to think about the business side of things as much. Whereas, you know, the external studios, that's their paycheck. So,
well, absolutely. Yeah. And the internal teams aren't reporting necessarily directly to you. They have a higher up.
Mm-hmm.
They're reporting to the company, and external teams are basically reporting to you. So they want to get done what you need done so that they'll receive their paychecks. It's not that they don't care, either team. They both want to make the greatest product possible. But it's a little harder, I think, for a producer to manage an internal team, because they have many other people to report to.
Mm-hmm. Jumping tracks to Brian for a moment, let's talk about where your book came from and specifically why you wanted to tackle a pretty esoteric topic. What is your book?
Sure. So the book is about video games, mostly retro in nature, because these died off after a certain point, which feature Japanese recording artists, and it is called Gameplay Harmonies, Japanese recording artists and the video games about them. And I've been listening to and translating lyrics for Japanese pop and rock songs for a long time, since 2002, when I was a part of a site called Mognet.net, which is still up right now. It hasn't been updated since 2010, but for as long as I'm alive, it will also be alive, frozen there in amber. But
which is no small feat. I have lots of sites that I created a long time ago, and they're gone with the wind.
I also coded the site as well, so every few years I have to go in there and update that to keep it running too, which is a whole lot of fun. But anyway, I kind of like solidified my love for Japanese music for years of doing that. And I've always loved video games since even longer than that. And as I kind of went on in my life with those two things, I sort of discovered how much they intersected, way more than you might think. And sort of an overarching point of the book is just how really interconnected a lot of types of Japanese media are. For example, manga will become anime, which will have a theme song, which will serve to promote that artist. The title will be adapted into a video game, and it's not quite circular, but it's almost there. And I feel like when that gets discussed, that the music side of it is not something that comes up a lot, especially in relation to the game side of it. So there were enough titles to support this idea over the years, and I wanted to do something that talked about those. Like, not, and even when you see them covered, because it's not like I've unearthed any games that no one's ever heard of here, right? But even when you see them covered, there will be, in my experience, a basic blurb mentioning the artist briefly, and then the rest will be all about the game. And since my interest is a little more evenly split, I wanted to create something that did both of those halves justice. So someone can really kind of understand the context behind the artists that are being featured in those, and maybe why they were and why they were important in that time period.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it feels like Japanese game publishers really ran with that idea. Like, here in the U.S. you had Journey Escape, and in the U.K. you had a Spectrum game based on Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Yes. But these were just like these weird random outliers, and no one really did anything to follow up on those for
it's
a long
true.
Time. You didn't really see Western recording artists make a contribution to video games until the multimedia era with, like, you know, Peter Gabriel, Explorer 1, and
right.
things like that. And that's not really a video game. That's more like, hey, it's me, Peter Gabriel. Come fool around in my studio and make your own mixes of my music, which, you know, that's fun, but it's not really video game-ish.
And there were Japanese versions of that concept, too, mm-hmm. to be fair. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, especially during kind of like the mid-late 80s, you know, you see a lot of these games. And I think there were a few things that kind of happened simultaneously, like the explosion of like pop idols there.
Yes.
And also the fact that video games got to a point where they actually could have music, which, you know, before the, like, 1983, 84, you didn't really hear
a
lot of good music in video games. It was just kind of little ditties or, you know, like Old MacDonald or, you know, some sort of, like,
public domain
piece. Yeah. So these things all kind of happened simultaneously with the Famicom boom. So I think
yes.
that really just sort of snowballed into something unique.
Absolutely. And some of these record labels, for example, Sony, also having game development or game publishing arms, I'm sure helped in no small part there too, because not every early case was, oh, the company who published them is also the company who publishes their albums, but mm-hmm. certainly some of them were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's something that I've been writing about recently, just the fact that video game music was actually kind of taken seriously mm-hmm. in Japan as a form of music,
yeah.
As opposed to here where you had, you know, some novelty Pac-Man and Donkey Kong songs in the early 80s, and then it just kind of went away. But you had, like, pioneering artists, what's his name? Hosono from
Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Mm-hmm. Doing remixes of soundtracks and, like, releasing those as entire, you know, like, sidelong yep. vinyl albums. I picked up the Super Zevius vinyl a few months ago, and it was just like, I can't believe this was, like, a pioneering video game electronic artist, or not video game, but just a pioneering electronic artist putting together something like this, which is like a dance remix from the 90s. In 1984, based on a video game. It's just wild. But I really feel like that kind of thing sparked a sort of cultural movement.
I agree. I love that you played that on an episode of Retronauts Radio, by the way. I think that was a long time ago, but I was impressed.
It was like 2 or 3 months, actually.
As much of it as you did. Yeah.
It's one of those things where you have to hear a lot of it to really
yeah.
appreciate the fact that, like, wow, he's really going for it. There's sampling
yeah.
and all kinds of stuff in there.
I think that definitely started this. And at some point I had to draw a line, because, like, the line between that and what I'm covering is fairly thin.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have taken me much longer and been a million more pages if I had also covered, oh, musicians who just contributed to video games in some way. So I drew a hard line at no, the artists themselves must actually be featured in and be a part of this game and not just, oh, so-and-so wrote the music.
You know what? We missed GACT for Final Fantasy.
But I considered it, but to me that didn't really count because yes, he was voicing a character. Or yes, I assume you're specifically talking about Crisis Core and Dirge of Cerberus, mm-hmm. where he was like
a character, basically.
Genesis Rhapsody or whatever that character's name was. But like, but it wasn't actually here is GACT. It was just that GACT happened to be voicing this character. So I made an executive decision to throw that one aside.
So this kind of gets into licensing, and that's something that you worked with a lot, Mark, really kind of from the beginning with some of your Mindscape stuff.
Right.
I don't really have a specific question. It's just all... It's such a broad topic because you were involved with so much of it with so many different partners.
Right.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how that experience evolved. Like, even with Matt Groening, like, when you first started working with him and then the later Simpsons games you worked on, you said, like, there was an appreciable difference in his approach to licensing.
Sure. Well, with Matt Groening, you know, at the beginning, I was at Konami when we were doing Simpsons, and they did the Simpson Arcade mm-hmm. game, which was pretty successful, and then we did some
right, and PC you produced version. The PC port of that, right?
Yeah. And then we did a PC original, and Matt was, we were all new to the gaming industry, and Matt was new to, you know, success and and games, and so that was fine, but what was interesting was by the time when I went to Acclaim, they happened to have the Simpsons license. And so I was working on some more Simpsons titles, and I believe, from what memory serves me, that Matt, his kids had just gotten, I think it was the N64 or the SNES or one
I
of
think
the
Super NES one of the, is what you said, yeah.
One of the Mario games. And of course, the Mario games are better than anything. And he saw that, and we were at the final stage of a Simpsons title at the time. And he said, no, I'm not going to approve this. We're like, well, you approved it the whole way. What's... Well, I just saw this game and, you know, you can do much better. We're like, yeah, we probably could. But nobody can do as good as Nintendo. And so things changed with everything. With you know, the gamers, with the industry. Things change. And game machines and memory... capacities and graphics. Mm-hmm. So you just try and keep up.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of an unfair comparison to hold up Super Mario World against
extremely.
Really anything else. I mean, that game, that was Nintendo's internal development teams working for 2 years to develop one game in parallel with developing the hardware that ran it. So it was, you know, like as custom made to take advantage of that machine as you could have gotten at launch.
Sure.
So it's, you know, like, yeah, that's kind of the high watermark that everyone else has to strive for. But I can also understand why Matt, you know, not being deeply invested in video games would kind of say, well, you know, I see what can be out there. How come this you know, game that we're developing on this very small time frame with a small team with a small budget can't be as good as what Nintendo's internal developers put together over the space of years?
Of course.
Like,
of course.
That's, you know, the nuts and bolts, again, isn't necessarily something that people think about and realize when it comes to video games. They just see the end result and say, well, this is good and this isn't.
Right. And in the early days, when you had limitations, a lot more limitations than you do now with memory and graphics, the creative teams, we always wanted to do more than you could mm-hmm. on the systems, but you know, you could only do as good as the systems allowed. So, like for a Marvel title, of course we want the characters to be fluid and gorgeous and huge and detailed, but in the early days of, you know, Nintendo system and the Sega Genesis, you did what you could.
Right. Yeah, and even then, you know, I look back at some of the games, Super NES and Genesis games, that did have like super fluid, gorgeous animation stuff that was developed by like Shiny Entertainment. And those tend to suffer somewhat in terms of playability because the animation is foregrounded so much. You know, characters have to go through their complete animation routine before you gain control back over them. And that actually works to the detriment of the game as well. So, yeah, I mean, game development is always a balance between many different factors. But I feel like, especially back in the 8 and 16-bit era, that was especially the case. Yeah. And so that's, again, kind of coming back to your book, that's what makes it so interesting, is because you talk about just kind of the realities of being the person who is sort of steering these ships and trying to let, you know, people be creative and do what they wanted to do and needed to do, but also saying, like, you know, here's the deadline, here's the budget, here's what the licensing partner demands, and so on and so forth. That's a lot of different factors for any team to have to keep into mind.
Absolutely. And memory was a really big one, because a lot of times on a game, you're like, well, we want a really big payoff at the end so that the player will feel real satisfied. But then you go, well, how many players are going to get to the end? And how much memory do we allow for that huge payoff? Or we want the characters in one of the Marvel titles, Maximum Carnage, we wanted a lot of, it was a huge amount of characters that we could include in the game, and we wanted some characters, you'd be able to call in helpers. Mm-hmm. But if we allowed it to be called in at any point in the game, then you have to figure out what animations are necessary for that point in the game, and it wasn't feasible. You couldn't do it. So you had to figure out, okay, how can we manage this? And we had to limit it to certain spots in the game where you could call them in. Or in a wrestling title where you have a ton of wrestlers you want to put in, but you can't. Mm-hmm. You don't have enough memory.
Right. Yeah, you look back at some of the people who really pulled off amazing things on Super NES, like Capcom with Street Fighter Alpha 2 at the end of the Super NES's lifespan. They had to use a special chip that compressed all their data. So when you play that, it's a cartridge, but it has loading times like a CD. Right. Because it has to decompress the data. And they still had to drop frames and drop elements that were in other versions of the game. And it's a miracle of a piece of software that they got that running on, you know, this system from 1990 in 1996, you know, kind of converting this high-level arcade machine experience into something recognizable on the home hardware, but it was still compromised. And those were, you know, those were some of the best people in the business. They, you know, they knew the hardware inside and out. They created the original game. They knew where to make the cuts. They had access to special chips that were only available to a few developers at the end of the system's life. And even with all of those things stacked in their favor, they still had to make compromises.
Yeah, sure. And then some games could have, you know, a memory chip in there, but it costs more. Mm-hmm. So as a company, the company's going, well, if we have to charge this much more for the game and pay this much more for the cartridge, is it worth it?
Right.
And a lot of times they gave you the, you know, thumbs down.
Yeah, I remember Rebecca Heineman was talking about how she developed the game Out of This World for Super Nintendo. And do you know that game very well? Yeah, with the polygons and like it's kind of a movie-style animation. And it's amazing that she did that, but they wouldn't give her an advanced chip to run it on.
Right.
Like it was like the bare-bones basic-level chip, and she had to figure out how to make this sophisticated 3D cinematic game run on the basic Super NES chip just because the publisher didn't want to spend an extra $2 for the chip because that would cut into their profit margins or make the game more expensive at retail. So, yeah, developers were making those kinds of compromises and hard choices and just, you know, dealing with publisher restrictions all along, and it's kind of a miracle we ever got good video games. it's you know, you look at just kind of the compromises and restrictions that were necessary in those eras, and it just seems like a lot of people being very stubborn and saying, I'm going to do something great anyway.
Yeah, and remember in the old days, I'm sure both of you remember that, you know, the where you'd have to play a video game and then you'd have to enter in, like, numbers and letters, like, you know, 15 of them.
Passwords.
For your password, yeah. For your save. Mm-hmm. And so you'd be sitting there with a piece of paper, yeah. And writing down your codes, and
you couldn't take a picture of it with your phone, that's for sure.
Exactly.
No, I've been working on some of those games for videos, and I do use my phone. I'm just like taking the snapshot, and then you don't have to worry, like, was that a zero or an O? What right. did I write down?
Exactly.
Was that a T or was it an F? Oh no.
Like, yeah.
An I or an L? those tricky ambiguous letters. That was always, you know, you'd sit there and punch in 24 characters and you misentered one of them, but which one?
Right.
It was rough times for everyone. But again, that was another publisher compromise, because battery backups did exist, battery saves, but right. they raised the price of the cartridge, and
right.
publishers said, no, don't want to do that.
And Nintendo would have them, and then the other developers or yep. Matt Groening's would go, why don't you make a game
exactly.
like that?
Yep. It's because Nintendo manufactures all their own stuff, and they can do yeah. whatever they want.
Right.
So Brian, we're kind of still speaking of licensing here.
Sure.
And kind of the realities of video game development. Are there any of these games that you covered that you would consider all-time masterpieces, or do you feel like they were created under constraints? I mean, you're dealing with licensing likenesses for artists,
yes.
licensing music. You have to deal with, you know, talent agencies. You have to deal with Jazzrak,
which is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah. Which Jazzrak is the equivalent of America's ASCAP, and they manage recording rights and licensing for music. So you get all these external factors built in addition to, you know, the realities of creating a video game.
Right. I definitely would say that most of them are what you would think of as a typical licensed game. Full of compromises, full of flaws. But a lot of them at least have something interesting about them. And I'd say, like, if one of them came closest to being an all-time masterpiece, like, this is maybe the obvious answer if you see a list of them. But the Miho Nakayama game, Tokimeki High School, it's... what it does in terms of being an adventure game, it's certainly not the first to that, but it was also kind of Nintendo's entry point to that, which snowballed into a lot of things like the Famicom Detective Club games and things like that. And it also involved...
It was a collaboration with Square, right?
It was a collaboration with Square, though God knows they weren't obviously credited for it. You have to go into, like, secret credits to see anyone's name who is from Square, so they were really trying to hide that. But it is a pretty high production value for the game in general. It has actually pretty nice chiptune renderings of a few Miho Nakayama songs. And they really tried to do something with this facial expression system that the game has. So I would definitely hold that one up as...
What's the yeah. premise of the game? You haven't really explained
it. Oh, that's true, I haven't. Essentially, you are a high school student who is just transferred into a high school, and pop star Miho Nakayama, under a very poorly disguised name, is also a student there. And you become closer to her and some of the other crazy students in the high school as you sort of progress through the story. And eventually it's revealed to you that she is, in fact, Miho Nakayama. And it spirals into this whole weird story about you being abducted by a rich girl who goes to the same high school and forced to go to her birthday party. And then you kind of part ways with Miho for a while and end up coming back with her in the end when, like, these agents try to, like, come and kidnap her or something.
Wow.
It's a like, little crazy.
It's J-drama right there.
Very much so. But it is entertaining, and it is very much an adventure game in that you can make bad decisions and get a game over. But it's also, like, the history of it is almost as interesting as the game itself, to be honest. Not just the aspect that Nintendo was involved in, but it also had very heavy ties to the whole architecture that was there around the Famicom Disk System writers at the time. Mm-hmm. They had a fax service where you could actually bring in your disk, which, of course, had your game progress saved on it, and basically upload it to Nintendo and have information written back on it based on the progress that you had made. And there were these ribbons, these different colored ribbons that would write based on the endings that you got, because there were a few different endings. And if you had the right number of ribbons, you could be entered into contests to win things, one of which was like a VHS tape, which I believe you ended up getting at auction.
I did win that at an auction to digitize. Yeah.
I watched it from Internet Archive for my own research. I did not try going after it on auction.
It wasn't too expensive, actually.
I didn't figure it might be.
But yeah, that's kind of an example, sort of like what Mark was talking about, of Nintendo sort of getting away with a lot that other people couldn't. Like, they, you know, they had that fax system infrastructure that you're talking about built, and so they could take advantage of it. They heavily marketed the thing, you know, in addition to the promotional stuff in the videotapes.
Yes.
You know, there was also the element of the actual phone calls.
Yes.
And that was something, you know, in the Portopia serial murder case a few years before that, like, phones factor into the game, and you call phones in the game
right
to get clues and stuff. But with Mio Nakayama Tokimeki High School, they actually had, you know, numbers printed in the game, and you would call those on your actual phone and get clues, and you know, that kind of makes it difficult to play at this point, I imagine. But
I mean, luckily people have figured out what all the messages are over time and documented them, so it's not really a problem if you're reading something that's kind of helping you through the game. But yeah, I would imagine if you really want to go in blind and not read anyone's walkthroughs or hints, it might be a little bit difficult. By all accounts, those were, unsurprisingly, pre-recorded messages of Miho Nakayama too. So yeah, phone numbers would flash on the screen at various points in the story, and with a message to tell you to write it down and presumably call it.
Right. Yeah, and the VHS tape is just kind of like it's like a day on the town with Miho Nakayama. She does a video shoot, talks to little kids, and then goes out and just
I believe
does
she's
fun
sitting
stuff.
In front of a TV with a Famicom Disk System hooked up to it at one point, and just talking about how difficult it is and things like that. Very promotional material, but
but yeah, that's, I feel like that's a pretty unique game.
It is
within the really within gaming, honestly.
It is.
So back over to you, Mark. We were talking about sort of the different roles you played at different companies. I feel like some really great anecdotes show up in your book. I don't know if you want to spoil all of those, but I have to ask, do you have a couple of maybe like two favorite anecdotes that showed up in the book, just talking about your experiences and at the game companies? I have my favorites, but I'm curious to know what these are.
Well, I always enjoy the time that I was working on wrestling, and I recorded with Bobby Heenan, who was a pretty well-known in the wrestling industry. He was a wrestler early on when he was a young guy, and he was a manager, and he went on to become one of the best-known managers and announcers in wrestling. And when I was a young kid, I went to a wrestling match with a friend around 10 years old, and we saw Bobby Heenan. He was in his 20s probably, managing a team of wrestlers. And we went up to him after the match and asked him for his autograph, and he said, "Man, I don't give autographs," which was really par with the character he played, because he plays a heel, mm-hmm. and he was just being mean. And then a young lady came up, and I remember it like it was yesterday, and she said, "Can I have your autograph?" And me and my friend had pencils and paper and everything. She had nothing. He's like, "Oh, sure." And he went and found some paper and a pen and gave her his autograph. And we walked away and we're like, "What was that?" But so, 25 years later, I'm going to do a recording session with him, and I'm in debate whether I should say anything. So I said, "I'm going to do it." And then we got in the recording session and I said, "You know, we met 25 years ago and you stiffed me for an autograph." And he said, "Really?" And I told him the story, and he said, "Well, that makes sense, because she had tits." And I said, "Oh, okay." And he grabbed a legal pad off of the desk we were in the room recording, and he wrote, "To my friend of 25 years, keep asking," and he drew a pair of breasts. And I thought that was kind of fun. So that
it seems very much in character for
him. It was.
Wrestler.
But he ended up being a very nice guy. Mm-hmm. So that was nice. And I got to work with a lot of athletes, a lot of talented people like Matt Groening of The Simpsons. Got to go visit. I do remember going once to D.C. in Manhattan. I'd visit Marvel and D.C. a lot because I had both licenses. And I went to D.C. one day, and the salesperson that I was meeting said, "Hey, Mark, you want to come check out the vault?" I'm like, "Vault? Sure." And he took me into this room in D.C., which had shelves and shelves of D.C. books, hardcovers and softcovers and trade paperbacks. And there was an elderly man sitting there that was the security. And the sales guy said, "Go ahead, take whatever you want." Oh. And I was just, like, shocked. And I had ridden the train in that day, so I'm just standing there, going, "Well, how much can I hold?" Right. It's like the supermarket sweepstakes.
Exactly. Why didn't I bring my suitcase?
Yep. And I it wasn't about value, because I didn't know what anything was worth, but it's just walking around these aisles, seeing all these Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, I mean, you name it, comic books. So that was quite an experience.
So my personal favorite anecdote from your book is the Dirty Harry anecdote. Which I think, you know, is interesting, because it shows that you had, you know, creative involvement with these games, even right. though, you know, I think people think of producers as just sort of pushing papers and managing budgets. But you got down and had your hands on with the game design.
Yeah, well,
sometimes
I got lucky.
For better and sometimes for worse.
Right.
In the case of the Dirty Harry room.
Yeah, well, I got lucky. I mean, like I say in the book, producers' roles change at every company. Mm-hmm. And I think partially it was Konami and it was Acclaim. There was some trust, and I had built up some of a reputation, and they allowed me to be in control. But the Dirty Harry, I was new, and it was the first developer I visited. I wasn't even working in the industry. I was a tester, but I was one of the older testers, and they said, "Can you go to Toronto and work with this development team, Gray Matter, and help them finish up this game, Dirty Harry?" And I said, "Sure." And I studied film in college, and I was like, "Dirty Harry, that's a movie? Awesome." So I went there, and we were working on it, and it's a game where you advance through buildings and rooms and all that. And I said to the developer, "Hey, since there's so many rooms you go into, and people should probably know where they went in the past. And I'm new. I don't know what's going on." I said, "Why don't we make one room where you go into it, and then you can't get out. And on the wall, we'll just write, ha, 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 ha. And you'll have to start the game over." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And we didn't think much of it. But as I was writing the book, I thought, wait a minute, I remember doing that. And I looked it up, and sure enough, people had written about it, that there was this room that you went into and you couldn't get out. And I would never have done that today, but in those days.
I mean, I feel like that's very much a product of its time. In the 80s, you had a lot of game developers who would just kind of do stuff like that because, you know, the rules of how to make a good video game and how you should treat players and what they should expect hadn't really been developed, you know, they hadn't really been established by that point. So, you know, there's a sort of infamous game called The Mystery of Atlantis for the Japanese family computer. And their idea was with that game was to make a 99-level game because Super Mario Brothers had 32 levels, so they wanted to make a game that was, like, three times as good as Super Mario Brothers. But, you know, not every one of those levels is a masterpiece, and you kind of jump around going to different exits and travel, you know, instead of going level 1, 2, 3, 4, it's like 1, 2, 11, 7, 33, et cetera, et cetera. And there are multiple exits out of different stages. And there's one stage you can go to that's just a black screen and you appear in midair and you fall and you die. And then you start at that level again and you fall and you die. So if you go there, that's the end of the game.
Right.
So it's really kind of the same thing. It's basically like, you know, you have to figure out your way through this game and there may be some dead ends. There may be some traps.
Right.
And I feel like as players, we had more patience with that sort of thing back when, you know, the rules hadn't been established. So, you know, there was a time that you could get away with that. It was probably during the NES era. Yeah. I don't think that would have flown Super NES, but
no.
You know, the rules were still kind of nebulous at that point.
And programmers would stick in little hidden things, and I'm sure they still do, but there was a time, like you said, in the early 90s when they were doing it a lot and not even telling, let's say, the producer or the company. Right. And then it would go out and somebody would find it, but they're cracking down on that a little more because things change.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know what works and what doesn't work until you try it. So right. There was kind of that age of experimentation and figuring out what works. Were there any games where you had, you know, someone tried to slip something in and you had to say, hey, that's not okay?
Well, I don't know about trying to slip something in. I mean, Midway was known for hidden features, whether it was characters or tweaks to gameplay. So there was always discussions at Midway about what was acceptable and what wasn't. And it could even be something silly, like I remember in one of the football games I wanted, they'd have different modes, big head mode, little head mode, different characters or animals instead of characters or God knows what, you know. And I wanted like one of the quarterbacks to be a hot dog. I thought that would look really great, this hot dog running down the field and, you know, like a kind of a mascot. Mm-hmm. And I remember some of the designers were like, a hot dog? We don't want a hot dog. But they had all these other crazy things. So it's always, everyone's got a different opinion. And everyone has different thoughts on what's funny or entertaining or playable or marketable. A lot of times you talk with marketing teams. Later in my career, I learned that when you work with marketing teams from the beginning, you usually have a better product. And so you talk to marketing teams about, well, what could I put in this game that would be a good hook for you to market the product. And that was a big thing in Acclaim, working well with marketing.
So when you say you end up with a better game working with marketing, and in what sense do you mean that exactly?
Well, you know, that, like you said, a lot of times developers, they just want to make a great game. They don't want to deal with the business end. Mm. And it took me a while in my career to understand that the business end can help you. Because there's a lot of games out on the marketplace that I'm sure everybody knows that there might be a great game that you loved that didn't do well. Mm-hmm. And there might be a game that was really not that good that everybody knows. And that's you know, due to marketing. So at Acclaim, one of the things that they did was, at least I remembered at the beginning, was try and put five things in your game that we could bullet point on the back of the box that are different from any other product in the market. So you've got to come up with something original in your title. And it forced you to not only adhere to that, but give the marketing people something that they could say, look at what this game has that the other games don't, and put it on the package and put it in the ads and put it on the commercials, and it's going to help sell your product. I mean, if you're not in the business to make something that you want people to see, I don't know, maybe you should be doing something else.
So Brian, over to you. I feel like the games you wrote about were largely about marketing.
I think I would agree with that.
Either games to market an artist or using artists to market games.
I think I would agree with that. I mean, for most of them, it's certainly not coincidental that like the time period at which those games came out were oftentimes the height of that particular artist's popularity. Something like that just wouldn't have
worked
otherwise.
Was that a matter of timing, or was it a matter of the game helped elevate their popularity?
I would say more it was a matter of timing, to be completely honest. I don't know that I can point to any of those games having really helped any of those artists be more successful. I think it's just, I hear TM Network or whoever on the radio all the time, oh, look, they've got a game on the Famicom. Let me buy this game. I think it's more, what would you call that? Like brand synergy or something? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Do you feel like they were successful marketing endeavors? Do you think some were better than others?
Some definitely were better than others. I feel like oddly many of them that actually came about during the what you referred to earlier is like the multimedia era, where you had, you know, all sorts of strange and interesting and sometimes not strange and interesting experiences coming up just because there was now a CD-ROM and you could do a lot more. I feel like a lot, not all of them, but a lot more of those fall a little bit more flat because they get lost in a thing that everyone was trying to do, really, you know, in the East and the West in one way or another. Those early Famicom ones were so interesting, even if they weren't good, that I feel like those were actually the ones that really had the marketing push behind them. If you look in old Famitsu magazines or what have you, you will actually see a good amount of ads for especially the first few, like the Seikima 2 game and the Nakayama Miho game. There are full page ads for some of those at the time. But when you get into the PlayStation and the Saturn ones, there didn't really seem to be all that much, at least print advertisement for them, because I think they just got lost in that multimedia shuffle. And consequently, I feel like those aren't as well remembered either, unless you were like a fan of that particular artist, because then, of course, you know about it, especially if you like games.
So the timeline in your book kind of tapers off in the, mid-2000s?
Yes.
Why is that? What happened to those games? Where did they go?
They stopped existing is what happened to them. Interestingly, they sort of end, like chronologically anyway, they ended life as educational software titles for children with like the plethora of mini-money games. They ended on the Pico, I believe, the Sega Pico, which I never thought I would write about the Sega Pico in my life, but here I am, someone who has one and has played it way more extensively than I ever thought.
What is it?
It is, calling it a computer is probably not right. It's a console.
It's basically a Sega Genesis.
Yes.
That's been
in terms
repurposed,
of hardware.
Yeah, into a sort of educational, like Brian said, it's not really a computer, but it's an educational device that has
it does not have a touch screen. It is a stylus. There is a stylus which is attached to it, and the idea is the software for it is a very large cartridge, but it's also a book. There's like a bound book which is attached to the cartridge, so you stick the cartridge in the top. It's folds up almost like an old laptop. And when you stick the cartridge in, you can turn the pages of this book while the game is actually playing. In the bottom part of the fold is a very clunky controller and also an area for a touch screen. So there are games where you are, you know, for example, controlling a member of Minimoni, like making their way through an office or something, trying to like navigate their way around employees. But also there's just a free drawing mode where you can just like color in pictures of the members of the group, for example.
And when was this out?
I want to say
it debuted in the late 90s.
I think so. Maybe mid to late, but it did also come out in America too, though I don't think it had as much software for it.
Mm-hmm. No, but I do remember seeing it at like Toys R Us and thinking, what is this?
I remember seeing it at like a Best Buy or something as well. But in Japan it was all kinds of children's properties. Like it was Minimoni, who was a pop group very geared toward a younger audience, but it was also like Ultraman and Doraemon, and and I think there were even Pokemon ones, weirdly.
For a Sega system.
Imagine that.
I think Leapfrog had something kind of similar.
Yeah,
with a cartridge and like a book.
Was it the Leapster or something?
It was something like that. When I worked in retail ages ago, I remember seeing those things on the shelf, like long past the point where you could buy a Pico here. So yeah, you're right, it was very similar. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you ended up working on a sort of educational-focused machine yourself.
Yeah.
That really didn't go anywhere, but it seemed like an interesting project. Just the concept behind it was pretty innovative, I think. Do you want to talk a little bit about your experience with that?
Yeah, I'll make it quick. It was called the Ion. It was at Hasbro. When I started there, it was already in development. And they had, you know, it was a great idea. I mean, they wanted to create a hardware that was for preschool. They had a ton of licenses, about a dozen licenses, anything from, I think they had Thomas the Train, they had Hit Entertainment things, they had...
I think there was SpongeBob.
They had SpongeBob, they had Batman, they had Spider-Man, they had Blue's Clues, they had some Hasbro things, My Little Pony... Mm-hmm. Just a lot of licenses. I had to visit like probably a half a dozen different licensors. They had it with about half a dozen different developers working on different products, and it was supposed to be. It was at the beginning of interacting with the screen with a camera. Mm. But the biggest problem we had with it, and that's, I guess, could be the gaming industry or the toy industry. One, budget. I mean, how much can you spend on your product and how much can you charge the public so that they'll pay for it? And the big problem we came across, and these are kind of things that hopefully people in the future may hear this and look out for, is every developer tested it with the camera in their offices. We tested it at Hasbro, but we never brought it into the home. Mm. So all of a sudden, toward the end of development, we bring it into a home and we focus test it, and we realize that the lighting in the homes, because you need your subject to be front lit, and how many homes have their lights where their TV is to shoot light at you? You know, you have your lights at your couch or whatever in the room. So the camera wasn't picking up the movements as well as it should have, and to get a better camera would have put the cost of the product out of reach from other products in the market. These are the kind of things, these are the business aspects of creating product, that you just run into problems. And so it didn't do well, but it looked great. The packaging was great. The unit looked good. The licensing was great. Everything fell into place. But that one problem.
And what year was that? What year did that launch?
That was probably around, I would say, 2009, 10.
So that was after Nintendo Wii, but before like PlayStation Move and Xbox Kinect.
It was right about the time of the Wii.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even Nintendo faced that same issue that you're talking about with the lighting with Wii, because it used an infrared remote. Mm-hmm. And you know, they would put together demos, and they sort of infamously had an E3 stage demo where they couldn't get the Wii to work on stage at this, you know, presentation being beamed to hundreds of thousands of people because they hadn't tested it and accounted for the stage lighting.
Yeah.
So, you know, even Nintendo, like even the giants get bitten in the ass by that kind of thing sometimes. And, you know, PlayStation and Xbox eventually kind of figured out how to make camera systems work with Move and Kinect. But I think, Move required the, like the magic wand controller. Yes. And Kinect actually did, like have image recognition, but I feel like it was a little early to be truly compelling and effective. But, you know, that was for a while, that was everyone, you know, was kind of jumping on that train and trying to sort of dominate it. So, you know, the Ion was kind of ahead of the curve in a lot of ways.
Yeah. No, it was a very, progressive adventure. And another thing in general is that toy companies' budgets are nowhere near game company budgets. So you're working on a game, and it could be a couple million dollars that they're going to invest in this. You're working on a toy company product, and the toy companies are used to putting out something inexpensive, plastic, you know, an action figure or something that they're going to promote at Christmas. It's going to... kid's going to play with it, break it, toss it aside, do whatever with it, and then what's the next product that's going to come out? Whereas video games, you were hoping it's going to have some legs, maybe lead to a sequel, maybe be on the shelf for a lot longer. It's a different industry.
Yeah, toy companies love their repaints. you know, just put out the same plastic but with a different paint app. That's been a part of the toy industry since, you know, I was a kid, and I remember, you know, seeing like He-Man characters that all shared the same body basically,
right,
and just had different heads and accessories.
Exactly.
Like the evil sorceress was the same as the good sorceress, just different in a different color scheme. Yeah. It's trying to work within those very, very limited budgets. Yeah. So you always hear about budget crunches and things like that in games, but I guess it's all relative. There is some comparative luxury to making games. And I guess you really kind of got to see all of that yourself working across these different industries and kind of sitting where they intersect in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that's more the sort of later portion of your book, I know, but it's interesting how much video gaming factored into the work you did, even when you weren't explicitly working on video games.
Right. That's kind of what got me in the door at Hasbro. I mean, toy companies are very closed, a lot more so than game companies. It's hard to get into them, and it's a lot more secretive. I don't know why. I mean, nowadays with the internet and everything, you kind of know everything that's going on. But when I got into Hasbro, the thing that appealed to them at the time that I was hired was that I had the gaming experience, because they were trying to, a lot of toy companies were trying to get into electronic gaming. They saw the money and the popularity, but they couldn't figure it out. And I think a lot of it had to do with how quick the turnovers are at toy companies and how low the budgets are, and they don't want to invest long term. So it was difficult for them. They wanted to do it quick, and we'll just throw out something, and they couldn't compete. But I had this gaming background, and so they hired me, and one of the big things I started to work on at Hasbro was there was a Littlest Pet Shop line, and they had little digital toys that were kind of like the Tamagotchis.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Yeah, where you'd feed an animal and kind of keep it, nurture it. And they had these little handhelds with little games on them, and pets, but there were no storylines and there was no obvious goals. You were just kind of walking around. And so I got into it and I said, well, first of all, I want to try and make a storyline with this. I also want to make it more obvious what the goals are, what you have to do. And I also wanted to try and design the housing on these as opposed to just flowers and pretty little colors. To, let's say, if it's a dog, maybe the casing looks like a doghouse. Or if it's a fish, maybe the casing looks like a fish tank, a fish bowl with, you know, kind of make it more personal and more obvious and more playable. And so that's kind of where some of the crossover is with video games and toys.
So you've talked a lot about, in your book, about working with kind of big licenses. You did work on, you know, original IP with different publishers, but also a lot of what you did was dealing with marketers, and you, or not marketers, licensors. You mentioned earlier about Matt Groening's change in perspective, but I'm curious if you found that just the general process of working with licensors changed over the years that you worked in the producer role, and if kind of expectations from licensors evolved, and how, if they did.
You know, I'd love to say yes, it changed a lot, but I think it's not that the licensor relationship changed or their expectations change, because everybody's expectations change when you're allowed to do more. When there's no limitations on hardware nowadays, and you can update on the fly as opposed to submitting your cart and that's it. But it's the relationship that I think changes depending on the producer. You know, a lot of companies and a lot of products I worked on, the companies would try and get away with things. Don't show them it yet. Wait till the last minute. They'll have to approve it. We've got to hit the deadline. As opposed to, I would always try and keep the licensors in the loop from the beginning, show them as much as possible. But you do have that balance of, if you show it to them too soon and they can't imagine where it's going to go, you get yourself in trouble. Yeah. But you want to show them what's going on. You want to keep them in the loop. And the more you do that, the better the relationship, the better the product, the easier the approval process will be. So it's like any relationship.
Right.
Whether it's a marriage or a partner or whatever, communication is key.
Yeah, I can see where if you pull that stunt where you don't show someone a product until it's nearly done, and it's not good, that's not going to do any favors for your future relationship.
Right. But it happens all the time.
Interesting. Do you feel like some licensors were more restrictive with what you can do? I mean, I'm actually surprised when you said that, by the fact that you said Marvel, you know, when you were at Acclaim, if you worked on Marvel, you basically were just coming up with ideas and saying, here's what I want to do. Right. I feel like these days, maybe it's because Marvel's a different company, but I feel like Marvel would not be giving people that much leeway, that they would be saying, you know, here's what we want. Please make this for us.
But sometimes it happens. Sometimes that happens. But like I said, it depends on the relationship. You know, of course, you go in, and usually at the beginning, before you're going to start a new product, you get in and you say, okay, here's our ideas. Do you have any ideas? Where do you want to go with this? I guess Marvel nowadays, because there's so many movies out, you're probably going to tie it into a movie. In those days, there wasn't even a Spider-Man movie out yet. So it was like, okay, any good storylines in the comic books? If not, we're just going to take a Spider-Man and one of his enemies, you know, Doc Ock or Electro or whatever, or somebody in, make a story. And you'd have to get it approved, of course. But nowadays, there's so much material and so many movies and so many storylines that you might as well just tap into one of those. It's going to help you marketing-wise. And wrestling, you know, I would pick the lineup of the wrestlers I wanted, and you'd have to get it approved, but that usually wasn't a problem. So I don't think it's changed too much, but different licensors are different relationships. Some of them are more easygoing, some of them are more difficult. Some of them think they know your business, and some of them don't and let you do your thing. Just depends.
Brian, I have to ask, you know, obviously you weren't involved in making any of the games.
I was not.
But I don't know if you've read interviews with developers or commentary by them about, you know, some of the games that they had their likenesses in.
So much to my surprise, I actually did get to do an interview with the, I believe it was the director of Tomalark, which was a game based on a previous PlayStation game called Toma Runner, which is like, imagine a racing game, but with just people running instead of cars. But they tied it in with Larkin Seal, who was and still is a very, very popular rock band, but God, especially at that time, were they popular. And he was very good with my request to interview him, and we did do a short interview, and it was amazing. And especially in this case, Hyde, the singer of Larkin Seal, loved Toma Runner. And so he had, like, a lot of sign-off on that game. There's even, like, footage of basically him playing through levels in there, and it's probably the best anyone can be in that game, I think. I certainly can't play it that well. But, yeah, him just talking about the creative process and working with them and, like, the marketing budget on this because Larkin Seal was involved was just amazing. They had an event on a cruise ship, basically a tournament where the winners got to play against Hyde, and you could actually win like one of his costumes that he'd worn in a music video. And he was even able to confirm details that I didn't read anywhere else, like what music video the costume was from and amazing things like that. The more, honestly though, in terms of interviews in there was another one, from a guy named Bert Snow who worked on, interesting, maybe one of the most interesting of these games, which was Stolen Song, a sort of interactive game based around Hotei Tomoyasu, who is, again, very popular at the time, still popular now. I just saw him in concert last year, in fact. And it was a fully American-produced game in Japan by his company at the time, Virtual Music Entertainment. And they'd done a game previously that kind of set the mold for this about Aerosmith. I think it was a Quest for Fame, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And they basically reproduced this with Hotei. And like, I had a very long interview with him in that book, and like his insights into the process of creating that were very interesting. Like, people often consider like Parappa to be the first sort of like quote unquote modern rhythm game. Mm-hmm. It was not. His actually came first. The Aerosmith one came first. So I got a nice eye roll out of him when I mentioned that most people considered Parappa to be the first one.
Do you know how much involvement the artist usually had in the games? I feel like some, maybe from like the multimedia era, were very much kind of personal projects,
yeah.
And some of them were just sort of like, here's our likenesses, just make a video game.
I feel like the multimedia era brought about a little bit more involvement. Again, with the two cases that I did interviews for, the artists were very involved. Like Bert Snow would talk about like having meetings with Hotei and things like that, and Hotei saying kind of exactly what he wanted the game to be like. But you can kind of see it in a lot of the other multimedia games, too. There's a Saturn game called Daisuke Asakura Media Romancer, which has, like, just an absolutely insane amount of details about, like, his musical setup that I can only imagine he was so invested in that he wanted it in there. And I think this was a case for a lot of these games, even though they may have, like, suffered a little more on the advertising end of things. I feel like because you had that multimedia aspect in there, probably a lot of these artists looked at it and be like, oh my God, it finally makes sense to have like a video game about us because we're not just like little guys running around the screen anymore. Like it can actually be us and our music. I don't necessarily have a lot of written evidence to support that on some of these, but in some cases it just shows.
So, Mark, looking back at the games that you worked on, were there any that you felt really came together the way you envisioned them, or do you feel like you were always fighting uphill against the limitations of time, budget, resources, etc.?
Very well put. Most of it was that. You're always fighting something, whether it's a deadline, a budget, memory issues, whatever. In my experience, hardly ever make a product that you go, yeah, that was it. I felt that we did a pretty good job on Maximum Carnage, the Spider-Man game. Like I said, there were some things we really would have loved to have done different. Wrestling, I think when I got to Acclaim, I took it to a different level, because in the past, I think the producers on the wrestling titles were just making two guys fighting. And I knew wrestling, and I wanted to add special moves, and I wanted to add little details about the wrestlers, whether it was theme music or things like you could knock out the referee and then cheat, or use a chair on the outside of the ring. Things like that, little details that the real fans knew, and I think that the wrestling games turned out really well. I think that the Dragon Ball Z... Boost Fury turned out really well. But for the most part, I think, I don't want to speak for all creative people, you always want more time and a redo, you know. But sometimes you get lucky on the first go.
Are there any projects that you worked on that, you know, didn't come out necessarily the way you envisioned them, but you think, like, there is a core of something here? If I went back to that, you know, and we did took a mulligan on it, like, yeah, we could really come up with something special.
Well, yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of game designs that I have sitting on a shelf that never even got into development. I wish we would have finished Marvel 2099. That would have been a great game. And then one other game that I always liked, but it just didn't turn out the way I wanted it to, was Bart and the Beanstalk. You know, the Simpsons always did spoofs. Mm-hmm. That was their thing. They'd spoof a movie or whatever. And I came up with the idea of, I said, well, Jack and the Beanstalk's a great story. We could do Bart and the Beanstalk. And we applied everything in a Simpsons way to make it seem like a Simpsons story. You know, and the main problem with it was on Game Boy. And the Game Boy screen, to show the giant and to show Bart would have to be so small that you wouldn't have detail. So what we ended up doing was having Bart bigger, which is what you're playing Bart, but you couldn't show the whole giant because the screen wasn't big enough. It would have been a different game. I wish we could revisit it. Maybe do it on a different platform. But I think it's a great idea, and it's got a lot of gameplay elements, and that's something I would love to revisit.
Yeah, that premise sounds like it would have been great for the DS, 3DS era, where you have the two stacked screens.
Absolutely.
And you can get Bart in there and also still have the giant.
Yeah.
So just to kind of wrap up, let me ask you, Brian, really, is there anything that I haven't touched on with your book that you feel like is essential for people to know so they will rush out and buy a copy once it launches?
I hope they will, based on just the conversation that we had. But no, I think we touched on a lot of the high points. If you're interested in kind of how the Japanese version of that industry works, I think this is a good insight into it. If you have any interest in any of these artists and their music, you get a very nice look at all of them and kind of like what the general trend, musical trends and to maybe a little bit lesser extent, game trends were in that decade. And it's just something that isn't talked about a lot in depth in equal parts. So even if you're just there for the games, or even if you're just there for the artists, I think there's a lot you can learn about the other half.
Let me ask you, for people who aren't familiar with these artists, which three artists would you recommend? What are your three favorites? To kind of familiarize themselves with the music that that you've covered?
I would, my three I would recommend and my three favorites are maybe different.
Okay.
Different rankings. One of them at least will cover both, and it's probably one of the artists that maybe people, a lot of people in the West haven't heard of. Pardon the name, but there is a rock band called The Yellow Monkey, who has been my favorite band for decades now. No qualifiers, not favorite Japanese band, just favorite band. They're an amazing band. They've got a great sound. They have a couple of games in here, and unlike a lot of the other artists in here, they have almost no Western presence, I don't feel like. You've got bands like X-Japan in there, who a lot of people know. Even if they don't particularly follow Japanese music. I would recommend The Yellow Monkey to anyone who likes rock. And I would say Hotei Tomoyasu, who I mentioned earlier when we were talking about Stolen Song, is also a huge recommendation. He's also a rock artist. He's very much more on like the innovation side of things. He's done a lot more like electronic-y albums over the years. He's done more bare bones rock albums over the years, and he's almost a little bit of a David Bowie figure in that he's like reinventing himself every once in a while to kind of go after a different crowd. And for the third artist, I would actually say maybe less in terms of the music, but more just in terms of like what an interesting idea this was. I would actually throw Mini Moni in there as the third one. They make up a not insignificant amount of games in this book.
Not as one of your favorites, just as one.
Correct. That
check
is
out.
One I would say that people should check out. I was definitely following Japanese music for the heyday of Mini Moni, so I was there for it all. This wasn't anything that I experienced in retrospect. They are very interesting just to see how enormously popular and like how many different products they were just plastered all over at the time and then just absolutely petered out and disappeared. So I'd say those are some of the three most interesting artists that if people aren't familiar with in there, they maybe should check out. And then, you know, figure out what you like and go in that direction from there. There's a lot of guidelines in this book if you're looking to kind of familiarize yourself with Japanese artists that could give you clues for directions to go in.
What's the title of the book again?
Gameplay Harmonies, Japanese Recording Artists and the Video Games About Them.
Nice.
And then, Mark, have I failed to touch on something that you think is a significant aspect of your book that people should know about?
No, I think if you're interested in video games, or specifically the ones that I talk about, I think you'll enjoy it. And then in the toy industry, too. It covers a lot of ground.
Mm-hmm.
So
if you don't mind my asking, who was your favorite game developer to work with in your time as a producer?
I would have to say, you know, and they were all different experiences. Mm-hmm. And whether difficult or not difficult, I have really good memories of all of them because I met so many creative people, but I would say Acclaim. When I got to Acclaim, they were at the top of their game. I mean, basically it was like Sega, Nintendo, Acclaim. They had every license you can imagine. We had, like I said, so much freedom there to run our teams, run our licenses, choose our developers. There was trust. It was like a big family. And it was just a really good experience. It was good to have it that early in my career because it gave me not only confidence, but experience and things to compare when I went to future companies.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for your time. And also thank you both for your writing. I think these are both very interesting and very unique books that cover facets of video game history that other people just have not written about or talked about. So it's great that these exist. I'm happy to have played some part in helping to have birthed them. But I hope everyone will check them out. I will let Mark and Brian give you their bona fides and all the details about themselves. But that's after our station break here. Well, not station break, but just the part where I tell you that Retronauts is a podcast that is funded through Patreon. So if you've enjoyed this episode and other episodes you've heard, you can subscribe to us and get bonuses and benefits and also help this podcast exist. So that's patreon.com/retronauts. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you get exclusive episodes just for patrons every other Friday, and also bonus columns and mini podcasts every weekend. I think the frequency of the bonus stuff is actually going to increase, as Stuart Gyp may already have begun publishing patron exclusive columns by this point, by the time this episode goes out. So check that out. It's patreon.com/retronauts. Mark, where can we find you on the internet, and where can people find your book?
You can find me on the internet just by Googling my name. There's a lot of information there about whether it's conventions I've attended, articles written on me, reviews. So lots of information there. And it's Mark Flitman, of course. And where you can find the book is at Limited Run. And in the future, hopefully Amazon.
Yes. Hopefully by the time this episode goes out at the end of May or early June, Amazon will be one of the places where you can pick up It's Not All Fun and Games by Mark Flitman.
That's correct.
And Brian, yourself?
Googling me probably won't do you much good. So probably you should go to 1millionpower.com, which is my site where I have a long time worth of translations on. I'm BClarkOMP on most social media, and I recently actually started doing YouTube as well. So that's youtube.com/BClarkOMP, and there's also a Patreon for that as well if you like anything that's there so far, which is patreon.com/1millionpower.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, online. Social media these days is pretty much blue sky and nothing but blue sky. So that's jparrish.bluesky.social or whatever their structure is. Jparrish is what you want to look for. You can also find me at Limited Run Games, helping to make books, both standalone and inside of packages. Here at Retronauts, and of course, making videos on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish. Anyway, thank you again, guys, for your time and your contributions. And I hope everyone will check out their books, because like I've said, I'm not just, you know, saying this to as a marketing tactic. They really are different, unique windows and insights into video games and video game history. And, you know, they should be of great interest to anyone who enjoys this podcast. So please check them out, support their work, and you know, maybe they'll be able to create new books in the future. Who knows? In the meantime, I will wrap this podcast and let our fine editor put in some cool J-pop tunes for you to enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and Yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin-star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling Yuzu Mango IQ Mix Hydration Mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.